All right, we're going on to the 11th chapter of Matthew. It was assumed by Christ that a person who was not open to Christ, open to the truth, would stumble over those parables. In the 10th chapter, we had Jesus sending forth his disciples. The things that they encountered as they went out, Jesus was not so much overwhelmed by their capacity to handle the demons, for example, or to handle healing, as he was glad for their being written in the book of life. I think that keeps the matter in perspective, whereas the search for spiritual greatness inevitably must lead to a deeper realization, thank you, of the human inadequacy. Because it's presumptuous. It is not presumptuous to seek to know Christ. It is presumptuous to seek to be special, to seek to be religious or spiritual. Therefore, we say to you, the thing that you must do is just nourish yourself in the Word and let the Spirit determine what He wants you to have. Your grasp of the Scripture, for example, your capacity to articulate it to others, your levels of faith to reach out. The Lord brings you along in time, in due time. If you tried to do today what I do, you would fail probably only because, not because I'm any better than you are, but because the Lord has brought us along a course that has made this a natural flow of life. Every day we're on the edge of desperation here. We don't have anything out there in the future. It's all just the jungle here in a lot of ways. There's not enough security for the average person, you know, to be my age and to be here, you know, in a position where tomorrow is the precipice is something that a lot of people would find difficult. Never as easy. But the point is that there have been a couple of years back behind that we've done a few things. If you tried to establish the same thing yourselves, you know, and say, well, I'm going to do this kind of thing, you might have a pretty difficult time bringing it off. Then you also learn your limitations. For example, working with the drug crowd, the boozers, losers and whatnot, you learn a few things about people. In the younger years, you tackle everything, you know, you assume that nothing is too hard for the Lord, so you pick up every stray that comes along and you do everything, you know, you assume that everything you do is going to be successful. But you come out with enough headaches and scars that you finally realize that it's presumptuous to just assume that the Lord wants you to do everything, you know, that every person that comes along who's on drugs or alcohol or whatever it is going to automatically, if they really have enough faith, going to get delivered. We've talked with Ernie here, you know, and that's the problem down there at the mission. They've been taught for years, those evangelists. They've got a crew of evangelists down there. I know the guys. I've been down there a lot, great deal. And we talk together, and I eat lunch with them down there and whatnot. Thing that they get embedded in their minds is, and the thing that they tell these young men is, old men, both kinds, things they tell them are pretty presumptuous. They assume, a lot of those evangelists down there working the street, that the guy that really comes to Christ, I mean really, really comes to Christ, is going to be delivered from his booze. If he's not delivered, he hasn't really, really come to Christ. Something wrong with his faith, or something wrong with him somewhere. So the appeal goes out to these fellows. Oh, don't you want to be delivered from this alcohol? So just come tonight, come to the altar, and so forth. I don't want to be sacrilegious. If I thought that was the holy temple of God, I wouldn't say these things. But I've been there, and I don't see much of the temple. You know, the appeal is there. And they promise the guys the moon. And they give them a rubber beach ball. because they, you know, they come on down now, and they assume if they, the only thing they need to do to get rid of their booze is make that step out of the bench there and come forward. And I have to tell them the truth when I go down there. But these are old foxes by now. These guys have been around a long time, and they know a con when they see it. And they pull a few themselves. And they're there right then, sitting in that seat for one big reason, that bowl of soup in the other room. That's what they're there for. They call it taking a dive. And here these fellows pouring their heart out to them, earnest young men, earnest pastors, saying, oh, come and Jesus will deliver you from your alcohol. And these fellows believe from the pulpit that Jesus ought to deliver them from their alcohol, if he's really there and if they're really with it. But it just ain't necessarily so, I have to tell you. But if you can bring a fellow to Christ on another basis, and you can say, look, I don't know what he'll do for you. Maybe you'll get rid of your alcohol, maybe you won't. Maybe you'll get rich, and maybe you'll stay a bum, I don't know. But come to Christ anyway, because that's what it's all about, is not what's going to happen to make you better on this earth. What's going to happen is to give you the only kind of life that will stick in eternity. That's what it's all about. And you have to tell them that even if you fail, even if you've got problems, even if you come to Christ and you still have trouble with the booze, that doesn't mean you're not accepted by the Lord. These are battles men have to fight out on a different basis. They've been conned so much that now they're pretty skeptical of the whole thing, and well, there are a lot of angles to that whole business. But the central issue of what we're saying, of course, is that coming to Christ has no real guarantees to it beyond just coming to Christ. You have to see a lot of failures in the flesh before you really get off of the presumptive kick that everybody you tackle ought to be revolutionized and transformed. Even Jesus had the same problem that we do. Not everyone that he tackled came through. Paul had the same problem. But it had nothing to do with one's personal faith. It had to do with just the way life is. Well, anyway, Jesus talked to the disciples and wanted them to realize that they were not themselves anything, but it was the power of God working through them that brought them to a place of deliverance, of their salvation. Now, coming to the 11th chapter, what we're really looking for is a touch of Christ. We want to know what Jesus was like, who he was. And we're not interested here in so much a word-for-word exegesis of the passage. We're interested in finding out what it tells us for sure about Jesus. Verse 1 of chapter 11, and it came to pass that when Jesus had completed his ordering of the 12 disciples. Now that doesn't mean that he was ordering them around. It just means in his putting them into rightful order, bringing their lives into order. Diatason. When Jesus had finished, diatason, bringing into orderly giving the orders to the 12 disciples, he transferred thence. He went away thence to teach and to preach in their cities. When John had heard, John who was in prison, had heard the works of Christ, he sent through his disciples and said to him, are you he who comes, or do we look for another? And Jesus answered and said to them, go and tell John the things that you hear and see. The blind have their sight restored, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor are evangelized. And blessed is he whoever will not be offended in me. Now we ought to look at that first and remind you of John the Baptist. He had a rotten life from the beginning to the end, making his life out there in the wilderness, eating locusts and wild honey, whether that locust was from the carob tree, breadfruit type of thing, or whether it was actual locust, it could have been either. But anyway, it was his fare was not grand and varied, was not gourmet cuisine. He suffered all the calumnies and slings and arrows of outrageous fortune and so forth against himself as the leather-girdled prophet. And all prophets in those days were pretty well spat upon, snubbed. And so he suffered as a prophet and then was thrown into this dungeon, this pit, about 10 feet down to live, to stay there for numbers of feet down, to stay there for almost a year. So John, languishing in this jail, in this dungeon, is beginning to wonder what it's all about. And he has a right to wonder what it's all about. It's been rotten. He's received nothing for his pains but pains. Now, I think you have to stack that alongside the modern day herald of the faith, you know, the sophisticated cosmopolitan dweller in the suburbs, split-level shepherds. The things are pretty nice for them, and they are well respected. Of course, if they'll join the local Kiwanis or Rotary, they're even more respected. They love these outfits. These scalawags love preachers to come in. They make mascots out of them. In my younger years, I made the mistake of going to one of those things, but never again. I think I only went to one in my life, but I could see the picture very fast. All these old roués and rakes and ruffians like to have a little touch of class, a little touch of holiness around of the cloth, because and you never paid for anything. You step inside the doors, you're treated royally. They're they're pretty not rowdy, but free lot of people, and the air gets pretty thick with things. Off-color jokes and words and so forth. But anyway, so this little green pastor comes in there, and right away he's the king of the group because it salves the conscience. He never pays for a thing. You know, of course, they always have a kitty in the middle of the table. If you make a mistake of some kind, drop money in the kitty. There's always somebody with a ready quarter or half buck to put in for the preacher. Always asked to pray. Nobody ever listens to it, but he's asked to pray because that just sanctifies the whole motley development there. You see, the city pastor often feels like that's where he makes good contacts. It's not where he makes good contacts. Only way to make a fruitful contact, or one of the big ways, is for those guys, those scalawags, to leave business at lunchtime and make their way over to the church and knock on the pastor's door and say, "Hey, I need some help." Otherwise, the pastor is just a mascot. But pastors of churches are a pretty well-respected group in the community. They're vastly different from the Old Testament, or the old disciples of the New Testament church. Paul considered himself the offscouring of the earth. The water that was washed down the drain from the mucking out of the corral. That's what he called. That's what he called himself. He said to these Corinthian people, "You have reigned as kings without us." And he says, "I wish you did reign, because then I would be there." It's not time to reign yet. So anyway, John had a bad time. But the great thing here, marvelous thing, is John's doubts. Are you he that should come, or do we look for another? From John, the forerunner of Christ, we get these words. And it's always very gratifying to me to be able to say to people who have doubts that I would be a little concerned if they didn't. To make it appear that everything is just peachy keen is ridiculous. You have doubts. That's how you learn. That's how you grow. Are you he that should come, or do we look for another? Are you really with me, Lord? Is all this so much legend or fairy tale, whatever? And the Lord is faithful to bring the answer back in one way or another. The confidence comes. Convictions come that you're on the right track. You could hardly live out your faith in the gutty encounters of daily reality without doubting something, sometime. But the question is what you do with those doubts, whether you let them swamp you or just set them aside and say, well, it's of the human nature to doubt. But that's the mind that is doubting, you see. It's not your spirit that is doubting. How do you know? Because you stay glued to Christ. The spirit is what glues you to Christ. And you can say all kinds of fool things, and you know good and well by nightfall you're going to be back talking to Christ again. People say pretty fool things, you know. Well, all right, Lord, you know, I guess I'm just not, this is just not my bag, goodbye. People say things like that. It isn't long before they're right back in there talking to the Lord and getting things straightened out. So this episode with John is extremely helpful to us because it shows us the humanness of John. It gives us the hope to believe that in the midst of our humanness, the Spirit of Christ carries us on. And we don't stop to question very much. You don't stop to say, well, if this is the way it is, I'm going to bug off, you know, I'm going to get out of this whole thing and go make a life for myself. You don't say it for one reason. The Spirit of God in you convicts you of saying it. It convinces you not to say it. The mind would say it easily. The mind would say it's not worth it. Why struggle? It's not worth it. That's what the mind says to you. But the Spirit comes through, driving in to penetrate the morass of human doubt and to hold us steadfastly glued to Christ. It's a great thing. It's a marvelous thing. I can't give you anything better than that. I can lead you down all kinds of holy trails, and the end of it all would be the same frustration. But I can take you to the cliffside, and I can show you how to get a few handholds and get up the side of the cliff, and you're going to make it, because the Spirit of Christ is going to be with you. But God forbid that I should ever give you the impression that it's going to be easy. So, here is John crying out from this pit, his despair, and saying, are you the one that should come? Jesus reels off these things. Well, we're healing the sick, cleansing the lepers, opening the eyes of the blind, so forth. And blessed is he who is not offended in me. Now, of course, the charismatic picks that up today and says, well, that's what we ought to be doing too. If we're really from Jesus, we should be healing the sick and restoring the blind, and so forth. But we have to realize, in the first place, we're not Jesus. Second place, we don't have anything to prove. Signs are not our thing. Why? Because a sign from Jesus was primarily directed toward the Jew who already believed in God, but needed to be assured that Jesus was the Messiah. The miracles were not to prove to an atheist that God exists. Jesus would not have stooped to do that. Jesus would not have lowered himself to try to prove that God exists. The man that hasn't been touched by the Spirit of Christ is not going to believe in God no matter what miracles are performed. And the man that has been touched by the Spirit of Christ is not going to need him. And miracles can be piled on miracles, and you'll always have an explanation. Doubt is a wonderful fabricator of explanations. And comes a miracle to you that could not have possibly occurred in any other way than by the divine intervention of Christ, and already you have a dozen explanations for it. Doubt is the great architect of explanations. Now, the Spirit alone can convince of the reality of Christ apart from the explanations, apart from anything else. If you read this Bible, chapter after chapter, and there comes the great realization that you're in the presence of something very grand and very practical, very meaningful. And as you keep applying yourself to the Word, Christ becomes a very important thing in your life. In fact, your whole life you take from Him and you live with Him. Not in any kind of religious exercises, but in the simplicities of just walking with Him every day. As these disciples, or as these prophets, let us say, gave their message, and John was one of the prophets, they were treated badly. The old expression, a prophet is not without honor, save in his own country and is among his own people, and so forth, is a good one. But these prophets were not appreciated by Israel. They were appreciated by God, but not Israel. And most of them were slain. Yes?
The word save means even.
What?
The word save.
Yes.
In his own,
that's right. Means except in his. A prophet is not without honor save in his own country. Means that the only place he is without honor is in his own country, among his own people. Yeah, you can double negative. You can say, have some. Man of God is doing really great exploits for Christ, and he goes home to a family dinner gathering and he gets the barbs, you know. He gets the barbs. And what he's doing is made to look unimportant. And somebody, well, what have you been doing? Well, we got this school we've been working with, you know. Lord's really blessing us. 20 students in it, whatever they are. Someone says, oh yeah, I know that school over there started with 50. You know, it seems like a little waste of time to be working with those 20, isn't it? You know, just a simple little statement like that. It cuts all the ground out from under you. The prophet is without honor in his own country. I think of these Bible classes. There are people in this country, in this world, who give their eye teeth to be able to go to a Bible class once a week in this fellowship. I had to write a letter to one not long ago saying, you know, it just, you have to understand that not everybody gets this kind of opportunity. A lot of people just have to do it by the tapes and get the instruction that way. And yet there are people that really do not much appreciate, you know, what they're getting. Not because I'm anything, because the Word is here. It's hard to find a place where you just come and study the Word in simplicity like this. That's all. The point, of course, is that people that are right, are close to it, don't always appreciate the impact of it. Now, all of this to say that the prophet in Israel was a marked man. He was the off-scouring of the earth. And Paul felt it as well as these prophets back here. And John was no exception. He had a rotten life. But, in the end, he had his identity with Christ. That was the big thing. Now, the miracles came along, and Jesus used them for signs to the ones who really were already Israel, but they needed an assurance that Jesus was indeed the Messiah. When you look at a passage like that, and you assume that today we ought to do these miracles, you open yourself up to problems. I don't say that God doesn't do providential things, but you have to rather look in terms of God's mighty works among men rather than miracles as such, because those signs are simply not being taken. All these numbers of people that seem to be healed on television have not evolved a large evangelistic response. You don't find great numbers of people being saved because there were healings. And one person I know who's been deeply into this observed that it seemed almost that the people who got the healings were less apt to go on in Christ than the people that didn't. So I want you to keep this thing in perspective. Don't use that passage to prove that Christians today ought to be able to go out and heal the sick. If the Lord wants a sick person healed, he'll do it. To use these today in the same sense they were used then is a misapplication. See, you don't have to say God doesn't heal anymore, but you may have to be careful how you use the word miracle. So people say, does God work miracles anymore? Well, I'm not sure the miracles as such are applicable to today, but a miracle is, after all, a sign. Does God heal today? Yes, emphatically yes. I think even raises the dead today. But watch how you use that. A semeion in Greek is a sign. Now, John is looking at Jesus. He's looking for the signs. He says, are you that he that should come, or we look for another? Jesus said, here are your signs, John. And John was satisfied. He saw the signs, because that's what they were all about. The signs were, or the miracles were, to prove to the believers that Jesus was, in fact, the Messiah. Well, you see how people can get way off the track if they start misapplying these texts. And this furnishes the proof text for a great many sermons on divine healing. There's a difference between people who were already open to God accepting Jesus' miracles as a sign versus those who were quibbling over this as a sign, over his deeds, and saying, well, was this really a sign or not? I think that's the difference, is the attitude with which they came to these so-called signs. But with the Pharisees, again, nothing was ever good enough. The Pharisees were seeking a sign. The remnant, the faithful remnant, was seeking a reality, the reality of the presence of Jesus. They were making fetishes out of the signs. And then he says to John, blessed is he who shall not be offended in me. So Jesus functioned in a way that made it very difficult for people to believe him. He didn't want to be easily believed. He didn't want to make it too simple. He wanted them to have to reach for it and to determine their willingness. There are certain ways. It's a different kind of it's an analogy, but it's not really one-to-one, you know. It's not that perfect. But sometimes when people want to get some counseling from me, I make it tough on them because I want to be sure they really are ready and really want the counseling. And I remember a young fellow that popped up one night at a Bible study, and he was going to have some counseling. Well, when I get through with those meetings, unless I'm set up for it, I'm usually heading out somewhere else. But a person calls me ahead and says, I'd like some help tonight. It's very likely that I'll work with them. And if I really feel that, if there are people that are in the meeting already and I can give them a little help, I'm glad to do it. But a stranger coming in just saying, well, I want counseling tonight, I've got to be sure they're ready for it. So I remember one young fellow that came one night to the meeting, and he was all eager, you know, and he was going to get some counseling from me. I had counseled him before, in fact, and not too successful, because he wasn't always sure that he agreed with what I counseled him and didn't always do it. But so he wanted to know if we could have some counseling afterwards. Well, I said, I'm tied up, which I was, but I said, I will be glad to have you call me on Monday and make an appointment and come up to the area where I'm at, and I'll counsel with you. I'll talk with you. Never heard from him again. Now, if it wasn't important enough for him to make some effort to see me, he wasn't ready for it yet. I weeded it out a lot that way. Now, as I say, it's not a strong analogy, but it's in there. The miracles Jesus set out here and the parables that he gave were such that it was pretty tough for a person to really be convinced unless the Spirit was working with them. He made it hard for people a lot of times, like the Syrophoenician woman who came to him and wanted him to heal her daughter. And Jesus said, look, woman, he said, we don't take the children's food and give it to dogs. That's not an easy thing to say, because she might have felt put down there. Because she was Syrophoenician, that means that she was a Gentile coming from the northern part there of Palestine. And he was implying that the message was for the Jews. Now she said, well, that's true, Lord, but we dogs eat the crumbs from the table. And that was enough for Jesus. He said, well, all right, fine, we'll give you some help. And he went on to speak of her faith, admiring her faith. He made it difficult for her because he wanted to be sure she really knew what she was doing. I don't think Jesus was manipulating to get her to say it. I accept in the sense that he wanted her to reach for it. I'm not sure he was saying it for our benefit, but more for hers. I'm sure he wanted her to reach for it. She did, and she was rewarded. Because the thing of Christ cannot be a by-the-way thing. If we haven't got anything else better to do, we'll show up. Anyway, the Pharisees sought a sign. Jesus saw through their phoniness, and he said, there shall no sign, that isn't in this text, but in other places, there shall no sign be given you except the sign of the prophet Jonas, and he gives the account of Jonas being resurrected from the whale. The things Jesus did were signs, all right. Faith, the faithful remnant of Israel caught them and were blessed by them and brought into a place of salvation by their response. Now he goes on with John. While they were coming, Jesus began into the desert, verse 7. Jesus began to say to the crowd concerning John, what did you go out to the desert to see? A reed shaken by the wind? Why did you go out? What did you go out to see? A man clothed in soft clothing? Behold, those who are in soft clothing are in king's houses, those who carry soft clothing. Well, what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yea, I say to you, and more than a prophet. This is he concerning whom I have written, behold, I am sending my angel before thy face, who shall prepare thy way before thee. Now, these were tough men, but they had one thought in mind, and that was pleasing Christ. Nothing else mattered. They wanted to please Christ. The man that takes this position as a man, as a prophet, has got to come to that. Otherwise, his feet are caught in gumbo. As well as limbo. Nothing else can matter very much. You're going to have to be able to lose it all and be a vagabond and have nothing and not care. That's part of the lot of the prophet. Not everybody has that lot. Not everybody should be penniless. Like Santa Claus is Nicholas, I guess. But the prophet is penniless, has nothing, zero. And if there were, just like Paul says, if there's no resurrection from the dead, where of all people, the most miserable. Why? Because he had nothing. He was a bum. There's that absurdity today to those people who are humanitarians that don't believe in God. How ridiculous. If life just is a short shot on the earth, then you go into the grave, there's only one thing to do, and that's get the most you can out of it while you're here. You're not here for very long. And then he says, "Verily I say to you, there is not arisen among those born of women a greater than John the Baptist, but he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he." Very important point, really, because the prophet just cannot have in his mind a reward in heaven. He'll get his reward if he's a faithful prophet, but he can't have that in his mind. It kills him. He's got to do it for no other reason than the compunction of Christ. If he does it because he likes people or wants a throne in heaven, he's back in the same old farcical rat race everybody else is, trying to stack up brownie points. There's only one motive that's adequate when you're out there and the pellets are flying thick and fast. Only one motive is adequate, and that is that somehow Christ within compels one to do this. Without that compelling, it's a motivational thing based upon rewards we have or rewards we anticipate. Well, it says, from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heavens, now your text says suffers violence. An adequate reading here is the kingdom of heaven is in affliction and the afflicted sees it. The afflicted sees it. In the King James it says the kingdom of heaven suffers violence and the violent take it by force. Doesn't make much sense. It was a puzzle to me until I came across a usage in the in Herodotus of the word biazo, which means to afflict grievously. And he speaks of a plague back there in those days, and he says the plague rather afflicted them more grievously. So then you can say the afflicted suffer violence, crowd into or press into the kingdom in their affliction. Well, we'll go into it more next week. Let's pray.